Hello, and welcome to another Sports Next Door podcast. My name is Owen. Today is Monday, March 25th, and I am joined, as I always am, by my neighbor Max. How's it going, my friend?
I'm doing well. Have you seen the new meme format that dropped?
I'm not sure. I may have.
I don't know if I'm embarrassed or proud. It's kind of sports related. I just thought it was some Karen, and I was seeing it over and over and over again. It's like a back of a white woman with like sunglasses kind of Karening. And you can just see the back of the guy's head, and it took me seeing it five times, and then I was just mindlessly scrolling like the For You Twitter page before I realized it was actually Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce.
Oh, I have not seen that.
I'm trying to scroll and see if I can find it now.
So yeah. what's the meme format? I gotta know this now.
Oh, here we go. Would you have been able to tell that's Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce?
I feel like, yeah.
I had no idea.
Oh, dear.
I would have to go into more internet lore about a birthday gangbang to explain where I for the first like and best meme I've seen in that context. I don't know if we want to devolve into that.
I feel like not on today's show. Especially not before the Lord's weekend in Easter.
Okay, then. It was sort of sports related, so I thought I'd mention it. Not the birthday gangbang, just the Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce meme.
Gotcha. Oh, I don't even know where to go from there. What a start to the pod.
This is why we have an itinerary.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we'll read off the first line. March Madness. Full swing. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Always a phenomenal 4 days of college basketball. I was bored at work because there was nothing to throw on the TV. I guess highlights just, they don't satiate after you got 4 days of nonstop games starting at 12:45, going all the way into the evening. And 'twas a really entertaining 4 days. I'd say we didn't get any of the classic March Madness buzzer beaters. We did get the late winner by Colorado in their overtime game. But beyond that, nothing too crazy in terms of the buzzer beaters of March Madness, but plenty of madness to go around. Couple of shocking upsets, most notably Jack Gehlke and the Oakland Grizzlies of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, take down the number 3 seed Kentucky Wildcats in their quadrant of the March Madness bracket. That was the biggest bracket buster. I had Kentucky in the Final Four, as did many, many other folks across the country. And that was the most notable event of the weekend. We also saw Duquesne with the upset. We also saw James Madison taking down Wisconsin. NC State has continued their miraculous run, and I believe they're the highest seed or lowest seeded team left in the tournament, but definitely are the hottest team despite being an 11 seed. They've won now 7 knockout games in a row going back to the ACC tournament, and now the first 2 games of the March Madness tournament. So great performance being put on by them. Beyond NC State, it's been a mostly chalk tournament. No 1 or 2 seeds out yet, and plenty of 3 seeds or 2-3 seeds left, and then 2-4 seeds as well. But it's you're going to have to beat some titanic teams to make it to the Final Four of this year's tournament. There's not going to be that outside shot team. I would put NC State definitely in the conversation that they deserve to have a higher seed than they actually were coming into the tournament. So a really strong class remains heading into the Sweet 16 next weekend. I think the games to watch for sure. UNC Alabama is going to be a barn burner. Gonzaga Purdue and then Duke Houston, I think, are probably the three marquee matchups we have going into next weekend's Sweet 16 on Friday. And then we'll get our Elite Eight matchup Saturday, Sunday after the Thursday, Friday Sweet 16. So March Madness, looking forward to another coming up next weekend over Easter. These poor families that are going to get destroyed by folks watching the TVs all weekend instead of out with the family doing the egg hunting. So just poor timing for Easter this year to fall on this weekend.
What was Jesus thinking?
I know.
All right. So it sounds like the men's has captured you a little more than the women's, despite last week's claims.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been intriguing from a highlight and high point perspective. Also because the first two rounds of the women's game, however great the teams are, it's usually pretty lopsided. You usually see tighter matchups in the first round of the men's tournament, whereas you have LSU winning by 30 in their second round. You have South Carolina winning by 40 in their second round game. You've got Iowa starting off. Their whole team was frustrated the entire game, and they end up winning by 27 over Holy Cross. So it's just the women's game, I think there's less parity across the board. But definitely going to be tuning into Iowa, West Virginia once we get off the pod to see the second half of Caitlin Clark's game as they continue to make their run.
That wasn't meant to be like a woke scold moment. It was just an observation.
No, we'll definitely be dialed into the women's tournament more next weekend. Again, just with the tighter matchups to ensue.
Gotcha.
Perfect. Well, that was our March Madness check-in. Beyond that, it's so much to dive into, and I'm not even close to an expert by any means. So we'll talk something maybe we're a little bit familiar with in the Toronto Raptors. Announced about an hour before we jumped on to tape the show, kind of right before the beginning of the Brooklyn Nets-Toronto Raptors game, was announced that Jontay Porter was not going to be participating in tonight's contest. For those hardcore Raptor fans, they would know Jontay Porter as the guy who stepped in to play a good stretch of center games when Jakob Poeltl was hurt the first time earlier this season. He can stretch the floor a little bit. He works hard. But beyond that, isn't anything too special, unfortunately. Not as talented as his brother, Michael Porter Jr. on the Denver Nuggets. But yeah, Jontay Porter seemed like pretty solid rotation guy. No one had any qualms. And it comes out tonight that he is under investigation by the league for some irregularities in his prop betting. And so the assumption or the clarifying perception of what this could mean is that he has a group or someone that he's betting through on his point totals, his rebound totals, his assist totals. And for someone of his, let's say, niche, someone of his not renowned popularity to see higher irregularities of betting, probably against other bottom six teams in the league's backup centers, the NBA is going to see if there's something fishy. And obviously with the incredible expansion and explosion of sports gambling across the sports landscape, there's been an extra eye of attention on these sorts of things, as there should be, because it does affect the integrity of the game. So something to keep a very close eye on to see what the result of it. And as much as I'd like to believe it's a one-off, you got to imagine just with how the world is and how much money there's involved in these machines that this can't be the only instance currently right now in the NBA or any other league for that matter.
Yeah. So just to be a little more specific, so far the investigation or the red flag or alarm bell goes off when a hard to wrap your head around amount of money is placed on such an obscure player for such a thing. I'm just kind of browsing Reddit here, and people are posting shares of stories and stuff, but I found this a little interesting. In the game on January 26th against the Clippers, there was increased betting interest on the under for Porter props, which for the night was set at blah, yada, yada. There was also an over-under for made three-pointers. That night, he played just 4 minutes before leaving the game with what Raptors said was a re-aggravation of an eye injury. He did not score in the clip in that game. He didn't attempt a three, meaning he hit the under on all his things. The next day, as a part of a daily report to users, DraftKings Sportsbook reported that the under on the three-pointers was the biggest money winner for the bettors of any NBA player props from that evening. So that's January 26th. I think something else got flagged. Like, that's the first check in the system, and then more money goes into it, and something similar happens again. Yeah, this is a story happening across multiple sports, as we'll get to, but the one reassurance is, like, you almost expect it to be these guys on two-way contracts making peanuts compared, like, if LeBron, I don't think LeBron James or, like, anyone with hundreds of millions in, like, sponsorships and contracts are going to have a financial incentive per se. And those are the players with the most opportunity and leverage to affect the integrity of the game from a player perspective. Having said that, there is a lot of personality sacrifices and character devolvement, I think, that comes from putting all of your time and energy into becoming a pro athlete, and rational decision-making has evidently not always been associated with them. So it's totally possible for massive debt to be accrued by players, and for poor risk choice to happen, and for this sort of thing to come. But because The Athletic is eternally paywalled, I don't know what the details were, but I was seeing some headlines or recirculating headlines about a story a couple months back from an increase in NHL player suspensions due to betting. Obviously, remember the Evander Kane stuff a couple years ago, but it just seems as this deal with the devil or this huge influx of money has come into the league, this is an inevitable reality. Was also reading something good about how it's kind of shocking that the NBA is the league that has gone the furthest into the betting when it probably has the biggest on the record betting scandal in the 21st century.
Yeah. And not only is, well, the Tim Donaghy thing is probably close.
That's what I was talking about.
Okay. Yeah. So it's in the limelight. I'm sure there's other international incidents that we just don't know as well, being here in North America. Mm-hmm. But it's not only the decision making of the players, but probably the folks around them, right? Like, it's typically not the players themselves that are concocting these ideas. It's something that's been influenced by a friend or a relative that says, hey, I've seen this happen, or I know someone who can do this, and it'll never get linked back, and it's an easy way to make a ton of money for the people that you care about, right? And these players work so hard, and if they can never cash in on that true paycheck to take care of everyone that they care about, then you got to explore other avenues. And it's just so highly accessible, and there's so many methods to do it, that it's going to become increasingly difficult to regulate and track. We've seen it across the NFL and NHL, like you mentioned, NBA. I mean, famously, Pete Rose not gambling on games, or maybe he was, but just gambling as a whole is what really cost him his Hall of Fame status. And another great baseball player is following in his footsteps as we jump here into the Shohei Ohtani story, which has dominated headlines for the last week up until this moment tonight with Porter. And basically an hour before the Porter stuff came out, Ohtani gave his press conference where he doubled down on the statement that was provided by his team earlier in the week, that his interpreter lied to him, stole from him. He's never gambled on any sports. I might believe that. I won't believe that he's never gambled before. and it's just, it's such a bizarre story all around that doesn't quite add up given the relationship between the two, how recently they've been seen hanging out together, and the sheer amount of wealth and debt that was accrued by the interpreter. Makes it hard to follow completely, but that is what the investigation is for. And so something else to keep a really close eye on here as, yeah, I don't know what's going to come of this.
Just to backpedal a little for anyone listening who hasn't been following the story, it came out around a week ago that Shohei Ohtani's bank account had sent a $4.5 million wire transfer to a illegal bookie. That's pretty much all that is known at this point. I don't quite know how the interpreter got linked initially. So then right after this comes out, what's the interpreter gonna saying, like, that it was his debts and Ohtani was covering it for him? And then, yeah, the story is all right. It's so bizarre and convoluted and shady that I'm kind of having trouble keeping track of it. But it's, the Occam's razor is the money came from Ohtani's bank account, and he, this amount of money is nothing to him, and it just is so much more believable that a bookie accepted like this amount of gambling debt from Ohtani rather than from a guy who makes $300,000 to $500,000 a year.
Totally.
There's Nate Silver wrote a really great piece just going over these facts, and then he has a lot of insight into the high stakes gambling world and how there's no like one type of really rich person. Some people are very careless with their money and will allow their friends and business partners close access to their accounts. And some people are highly protective and on the nose with this sort of thing. We really don't know one way or the other from Ohtani. The other thing I saw, I don't know if this has been updated, was that the MLB wasn't really directly investigating Ohtani. It was more indirect and nebulous, like listening to allegations. But it's pretty clear their interest would be in Ohtani not being found guilty of having gambled on baseball.
Yes.
And it would be a massive blow to the league if he was.
Maybe even a death blow, potentially, with an already declining viewership. Yeah. It's the humorous part in it all is, and I'm stealing this joke definitely from the internet, but the idea that Ohtani knows he's a gambler, and so he set out to offset this contract so he can only make a little bit of money every year for 25 years instead of making it all up front. And so,
well, that was another thing Silver pointed out. Like, that in and of itself is actually quite financially irresponsible, because if you make all that money up front, you can start earning equity and interest on that money, and is actually, so you can even argue that either way.
I know. So, well, that just paints a poorer picture for him, but it's funny and interesting, and it definitely should be the number one story here as we move towards this head of the MLB season, because it has more implications than really just Major League Baseball and how you are going to manage the absolute stars of your sport who have all of this power and influence.
Yeah, it's certainly something I think we should keep our eyes on and keep following as new developments come, but my like expectations that this is settled above the board and all put into daylight to be disinfected and we end up with the real hard cold truth of what happened are pretty slim.
All right, well, we'll step away from gambling and We will go into tennis here as we get an update from the Miami Open.
Yeah, so the round of 16 has almost been completely finalized at this point in the sport. Just one match left, if it hasn't been finished already, with Ben Shelton and Lorenzo Musetti still going at it. It's been a very rainy start to Miami, which has been unfortunate. A lot of delays, almost an entire day of play missed, and that so much worse in the early rounds when there's so many more matches to be played. So the schedule is just slowly getting back on its feet and recovering from all those delays. That coupled with just the weird venue of it all kind of happening in a stadium. Casper Ruud, one of the most nice, mild-mannered guys on the tour, did a really great job showcasing what respectfully complaining to a ref should look like. Just saying, like, we're in trailers, we don't even have cold water or towels, what is going on? So it's been a bit of an off-putting start to the tournament for me. That combined with a real lot of top seeds dropping out, especially American top seeds dropping out in those first rounds. We are regressing back to the mean, though, as it is almost fully seeded players left, the top four all remaining in their quarters so far, that being Alcaraz, Sinner, Medvedev, and Zverev. All players just doing what they do best so far. Medvedev putting on a bamboozling defensive clinic against Cam Nori last night. Sinner looking his untouchable, powerful self. Though he did get into a spot of bother against Hallen Griekspoor, dropping the first set and then getting helped out by a rain delay to come back. Alex Zverev, the serving has been on point. He was able to get through a tight first set against Chris Eubanks and then never look back earlier today. And then just finished watching Carlos Alcaraz and Gael Monfils play what was some really, really entertaining and fun tennis, but also a really disappointing ankle. I don't know if injury is the right word, because there was no stoppage of play and he did seem to be moving normally right after Monfils. But it did just cause him to get broken right away. And then he stumbled into that second set, went down a double break before he really started playing again. But the beginning and end of that match was just fantastic tennis, with Monfils doing everything he does best, with the sensational winners and hitting and movement coming from all angles, which just served as a canvas for Alcaraz to show how ridiculously good and on top of the world he seems to be right now. And where it takes like four or five shots that would be winners or generate a put away against anyone else, he just continuously defends and makes you work so hard, moves so well. I think Monfils saying like he's too fast, he hits too hard, he's just too good to his corner a couple times. That match, the freshest one in my mind, having literally just turned it off. And those three looking to continue the recent history of all making it to the semis, and the way they're all playing, I'm not sure I can bet against it. A couple other names to highlight, though. I didn't know his name somehow at Indian Wells, but Marozan, who beat Alcaraz in their first meeting, has now made it to the round of 16 in every Masters 1000 event he has played in, which is simply ridiculous for someone ranked in the 50s in the world. He takes out Holger Rune in a masterclass in the round of 64, wins his round of 32 matchup to set up a meeting with top 10 Alex de Minaur. So that match I've got circled. And then still looking at Casper Ruud and Nicholas Jarry will also be playing, waiting to see if Casper can recover. Hubert Hurkacz, a former champion at this tournament, is going to play Grigor Dimitrov. That should be really fun. The winner will likely face Alcaraz in the quarters. if Alcaraz can get through either Shelton or Musetti. So a bit of a strange start to Miami. It does seem to be returning to form. I'm like fingers crossed for that Alcaraz Zverev and then Medvedev Sinner semis. I think Alcaraz Sinner has to be the best match you can hope for in the finals at this point. Though Medvedev could be fun too, with the surface being a bit faster and a chance for some immediate Masters 1000 revenge. Once that's done, that's basically the first quarter of tennis wrapped up. So looking forward in the near future to checking in on all that and just talking about how this first quarter has gone in general, regardless of Miami. But that's all I got for now on the tennis side of things. We've got a couple more things to check in on.
Yeah, so first quarter wrap up on tennis. We'll head over to talking hockey where, I mean, the Leafs at this point just are pacing towards a date with either Florida or Boston in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Tampa's in their rearview mirror and steadily approaching, but I think Tampa's going to run out of runway to really catch the Leafs at this point. So Toronto set pretty much in their spot for the first round of the playoffs. And because of this, we've seen some experimentation happening with Sheldon Keefe and with Marner out of lineup, with Yarncroke out of lineup, and then Bertuzzi missing Saturday's game against Edmonton. We saw a real shakeup with the lines that paired Austin and Willie back together for a bit and had Max Domi really at the forefront of what the Leafs are trying to do. And I mean, it was a spectacular performance against an Oilers team. I'm quite surprised that Edmonton stepped into Toronto on a Saturday night and didn't bring their best game. And the Leafs really took it to them for those first two periods, 5-0 after two. And finishing the game 6-3, Zach Hyman scored his 49th and then his 50th the next day. So Zach Hyman at 50 goals. Austin Matthews scored an empty netter to get him to 58. And just a big showing for the Leafs against one of the top contenders in the West. And then they turn around, head to Carolina on a back-to-back. And that's kind of a schedule loss there for them, playing at 6 p.m. the next night on the road after playing at home. It's a bit of a trip, and so it's tough to put that one against them. And they sit now only 4 points ahead of Tampa with a game in hand with 12 games left to play. So
it's plenty of runway.
Yeah, it's actually tighter than I thought when I was last looking at it. I'm surprised it's actually that close. Tampa Bay has been red hot last stretch, and Nikita Kucherov had McDavid catch all the way up to him in the points race, and then he wrestled it back. The Leafs are going to have potentially a lighter stretch here against New Jersey, Washington, and then Buffalo on Saturday. So some definitely winnable games ahead for them before they play Florida next Monday.
Washington's been hot too.
Yes, but the Leafs just beat Washington recently in convincing fashion. Mm-hmm. So, interesting. And I guess that falls into here, though, is with the Metropolitan being the potentially weaker division. Oh, I guess it doesn't matter at this point because the Rangers are now ahead of the Panthers in the standings.
Yeah, that's a coin toss.
So the Leafs could end up playing Florida or Boston anyways in the first round if they end up in a wild card spot.
Yeah,
that's the thing about these playoffs. You just get in and then you got to just beat anyone in front of you. It's not really a given either way. Yeah, wow. So the Canucks, Avalanche, Rangers, Panthers, Hurricanes, and Bruins are all within a point of each other for the President's Trophy.
Wow.
It's kind of an exciting race to the end here.
Yeah, you don't get that very often.
And then in a race of their own, oh, dear Lord, Columbus is not good, and San Jose is worse. It'd be cool to have the Sharks getting the first overall pick.
Yeah, they deserve a bounce back at this point.
Yeah. And then Vegas clinging on for dear life to that eighth seed. They're going to be favorites if they get in, but they just got to get in, which we already talked about at the trade deadline.
Exemplifies like exactly what you want to take some confidence from that if you're the Leafs. Like, hey, the defending Stanley Cup champions who no one will pick against in the playoffs might like just scooch in and have to take on the best team in the West.
It's different that they have weapons waiting, though. We don't really have any weapons waiting except Marner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's your hockey check-in. It was just Owen discovering standings for the first time.
It's just white guys podcasting, reading shit online off the internet.
Yeah. Nothing better.
Speaking of, I am incredibly disappointed to announce that we will not be covering the trial I have been hyping up, where the UFC tries to defend its contract status and gets accused of running an illegal monopsony and just stifling competition, because the UFC has settled with the two lawsuits against it. The plaintiffs were alleging $1.6 billion in damage for this class action lawsuit. They will settle for $320 million. So many people were pointing out that's about the distribution of what the UFC makes versus what they pay its fighters, which is what this whole fucking thing was about in the first place. So back to white guys reading shit they read off the internet and calling it a podcast. Nate Quarry, one of the fighters pretty involved in this podcast or in this lawsuit, was asked about this on Reddit, and he did give an answer. So I thought this was better than any journalism I found, so I thought I'd just read it. No, we didn't get everything we wanted. Our goal all along was to change the sport. However, we had quite a few delays that we had to deal with, and to get injunctive relief, i.e. change the sport, we would have had to refile both lawsuits and combine them, go through discovery all over again, retake depositions, about a 5-year delay, and then hope we get granted class action status again. We'd be looking at another 10 years just to be where we are today, with no guarantee of winning any punitive amount of injunctive relief. As I say, weighing all the possible outcomes, this seemed the best outcome. We're not high-fiving one another, but we are pleased that a lot of fighters are going to be getting some compensation for being underpaid. Wish we could have done more. Over time, I'll be able to speak more in depth about all this, but for now, with apologies, this is about it. And it does seem 45 to 60 days more information will come out about this. So just a couple thoughts for now. One other thing he said in a follow-up comment was like, what some people complaining don't seem to get is we have to win every time in court. The UFC just has to win once. And so with that threat and outcome weighing on their mind, they decide to settle. So I think there were about 1,200, give or take, fighters who are automatically in the class action lawsuit. You kind of hope guys like Conor McGregor and John Jones will opt out. They don't really need that, their split of that $320 million. I don't know how much goes to lawyers, but for guys who made maybe like tops 100, 200,000, giving up years of their life probably, and who knows how much brain damage, this could be huge. So I'm happy that those fighters who fought between, I think it was 2010 and 2017, are going to get paid. The other thing is like, I don't see what, like the UFC is not going to change its contract practices. So I don't see what stops other fighters from like dropping the exact same lawsuit from a new period, like 2018, say, onwards. But it's just like the house always wins, right? Like this is ultimate, like I had a lot of hope. It seemed like this, there were so many textbook examples of such blatant misconduct on the UFC's part that I really was letting myself get optimistic that there was no way this couldn't go the fighter's way, and that once this was all exposed and like it came out, even with like evidence probably being hidden and destroyed, there was still going to be enough to really change things. But the house almost always wins, and just they're able to settle for what's peanuts to them. It's even fucking tax deductible for the company. It's just really depressing. And I don't say this name on his side very often, but I think the best way to highlight this is talk briefly about Conor McGregor, who's been in the news a bit this past month. He gives an interview maybe 10 days ago just saying, I don't know what's going on. Like, the UFC has not been talking to me. I've been in training camps and nothing has happened. And just despondent. Like, and it really paints a picture where this is one of the most commercially successful mixed martial arts athlete of all time, one of the most marketable combat athletes of all time. And there has just been zero communication from the UFC and effort to book fights. He has two left on his contract. And the cynical common take is that the UFC would rather have him dwindle into obscurity and not fight and just sail out his prime, then let him fight as often as he wants, and then go box and do whatever he wants when he's not under contract. And without him signing some 8-fight extension, he's already 35, 36 years old. They've just dragged their feet over this last year and a half. He has since said that it's all settled, all systems go, the fight with Chandler is happening this summer. After that, there's still one more fight he would have to clear to be through with his contract, but the best case is the end of this year. And really, this fight has been announced so many times unofficially that like this summer seems very unlikely, and I would be shocked if the follow-up was 2025 at best. It just highlights like how the UFC has put making itself the center of the market as its first priority and really tried to choke stars down and held a monopoly. And it seems like that is going to continue for the foreseeable future. It's fucking depressing, man. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or just want to end the podcast on a slightly lighter note.
Yeah, I just want to cheer everyone up with another Toronto FC win. This is the most soccer we talked even like... at all, anywhere.
1 minute and every pod, 3 pods in a row.
I mean, I got to buy my tickets now before they go through the roof. A win over Atlanta FC this past weekend. Bernadeschi looked out of this world. And they finally got a striker in Spicer who looks like he has a little bit of finish to him. And this team is just way more structurally sound with the pickups that they have on defense in the midfield that fans have been screaming about for maybe a decade. Like, even the TFC at their peak could never defend very well. They just had an onslaught that you couldn't stop. And so the team in front of us now is much more structurally sound. And they've got the top end talent. We're really hoping here that Lorenzo Insigne is not out for an extended period of time after he went down late in that game. But yeah, just a fun time to be a TFC fan heading into, it's fun that they're good heading into the summer so that they're going to get a lot earlier of a bandwagon from all of these fans that are just looking for soccer to get big in Canada as we gear up for, of course, the World Cup. On that note, Canada qualifying for the Copa America, beating Trinidad and Tobago on Saturday, and booking their ticket. They play Lionel Messi, I believe, June 20th to kick off that tournament, which will be quite the match.
Wow. A lot of things happening. I thought there wasn't going to be much to talk about, but we have literally 10 seconds left for me to say thank you everyone for listening. Till next time, Sports Next Door, signing out.
You get to the station, there's this crazy sound. Hey man, this ain't no fishing town. Yeah, they're fishing, that ain't all.